ಓಂ ಸಹನಾವತು ಸಹನೌಘ್ನತು ಸಹವೀರ್ಯಂ ಕರವಾವಹೈ ತೇಜಸ್ವಿನಾವಧೀತಮಸ್ತು ಮಾ ವಿದ್ವಿಷಾವಹೈ Preachers travel of sukshma sharira, subtle body, while death and birth. So we know that our personality consists of these two bodies. What is visible is the gross body, which is perceptible of senses. And there is something within the gross body which imparts life or sentiency to this gross body. Meaning that this body is alive not only on its own account, but it's alive because of there is something within that called subtle body which imparts the sentiency or life to this body. Just as electricity imparts the glow to the bulb. So when the bulb glows, it's not its own account, it is on account of electricity. Or a better example is that of a fan. How electricity first energizes the motor in the fan, and that in turn revolves the blades. Similarly, consciousness or self first enlivens the subtle body within, which is like a motor, and that in turn enlivens this gross body. So this is the setup. Now, what happens when death happens? Death is the phenomenon where the subtle body departs the gross body. Understand, the Atma, the consciousness, doesn't go anywhere. It is motionless, all pervasive. So, as we said earlier, the self of the consciousness imparts first the sentiency to subtle body and through that to the gross body. So when subtle body departs, even though conscious self is there, Satchidananda, and still because subtle body is not there, the gross body becomes lifeless because it being alive was due to the presence of the subtle body. Subtle body departs and goes to another embodiment, what we call the transmigration, takes the next birth. The next question is, what determines this? What intelligence determines where and which body to enter during birth? It is the karma. The karma or actions performed by the subtle body, which is what determines what its destination will be. So if there is predominance of punya karma, virtuous deeds, then he will gain birth in superior embodiments. If the karma is predominance of papa karma, vicious actions, he will gain birth in the lower embodiments, inferior embodiments. He said that if the karma is the sort of combination of punya and papa, virtue and vice, he will born as a human being. Basically, what decides the destination is the karma. It is said in the Upanishad that while this subtle body called jiva, what we call jiva, or the individual soul, is nothing but a subtle body. And subtle body being what it is, like a pool of water, of which the nature is to reflect any lighted body. If there is water in a bucket and the sun is shining in the sky, then it is the nature of water to reflect that sun. So also it is the nature of subtle body to reflect consciousness. Wherever subtle body is, the reflection of consciousness is there. Therefore, the subtle body with the reflection of consciousness, or the consciousness with subtle body, is called the jiva, or what you call the individual self. And that's what transmigrates from one gross body to the other. And the Upanishad says that when this jiva is about to depart this body, first of all, the whole personality is withdrawn into the heart. And then, from the heart, a number of nerves radiate. 101. That's called nadi. Of it, the one called Sushumna goes straight from the heart all the way to the crown of the head. And the other nadis, they radiate in different directions. So the destination is determined by which opening this jivatma leaves. Like the heart is as though 101 openings, and the jivatma will leave from one of those. If it leaves from the central one, it will go to Brahmaloka straight. And depending upon which other opening or nerve he leaves, accordingly he will get the embodiment from higher the aperture, higher embodiment, lower the lower embodiment. He also said that while this jivatma is about to depart from the body, first, as I said, the whole personality is withdrawn into the heart, and from there it leaves. And while when it is about to leave, it is said that at that time he has this vision of what his next embodiment is going to be. This is like a light in which this jivatma sees what the next embodiment is going to be. Therefore, when he departs, this gross body departs with the knowledge of where he has to go, and that karma will take him to that embodiment. So this is the setup. Can this happen anywhere on earth? Yes, it can happen anywhere in the cosmos. Because as our scriptures describe, earth is one of the realms. There are 14 realms that are described, 7 up and 7 down. And therefore, and according to them, there are, just as on the earth there are all these mortal beings and living beings, and the corresponding objects of perception and objects of enjoyment, so also in a higher realm there will be the jivas of those embodiments, in lower realm those are different embodiments and different things. According to karma, he will wind up in one of those. Meaning that it is not that after departing from this body we are necessarily born on earth. We could be born in heaven also, or in the hell also, depending on our karma. Is that clear, the question? You don't know whether the question is in present or not. Oh, it's okay, good. When unexpected reactions occur from ourselves in response to events, unexpected reaction, impulsive reaction, just get angry and burst out and things like that, which do not have really explanation. Why did I react like this? I do not have an explanation. Why did I say what I did? Why did I act in the manner that I did? I don't know. Could this be due to vasanas? How do we deal with it? Yes, you can say that it could be due to vasanas. Vasanas means latent impressions. Nothing but the subtle state of karma. And so, any reaction that occurs is due to karma. Which karma becomes fructified at that moment depends, you know. And that's what determines. But then, there may be all these latent impressions called vasanas or tendencies. And when they govern our mind, then we do not have any control. They control what the response is going to be. So, you can call it due to vasanas, you can call it due to karma, you can call it due to habitual error, but it's mainly these impulses called kama, krodha, lobha. As Lord Krishna explains in the Gita, the lust, anger, greed and similar impulses, they just arise in a given situation. And that also will be determined by karma or vasana, you know. So, yes, our karma determines what we do. Therefore, we may not have an explanation. Very often explanation is there. Why did I react in a certain manner? There may be an explanation. That I may have history with this person. The person towards whom I reacted, there may be history. The raga-dveshas are the reason, we can say. The raga-dveshas that are potentially imprinted on our mind, they very often determine how I react. It is this person, in this event, the person to whom I reacted, that person may have triggered by saying something, doing something, by the behavior, even by the presence also. That person or the event may be responsible for triggering, pushing a button. So when a button is pushed, then it triggers things that are already there, and that's what brings out the reaction. So reaction has a reason. That a given person or an event or a situation has triggered or pushed a button. Button means that the potential of reaction is already there, and they just become instrumental in only arousing of that reaction. So we can blame that person for anger. But basically, the potential of anger is already there within me, and that person became instrumental in pushing the button. Meaning that we are like those remote control dolls. When somebody pushes the button and then we start dancing, as dogs do that. We are also like that. Whenever we are controlled by reactions, then people manage to push buttons from there. Sometimes I don't even need a physical presence. Even a thought in my mind is enough. When I hate a person, the very thought in me creates anger. When I love a person, then thought just creates in me a reaction of attachment. The explanation for my reaction is that the potential is already there in me. Again, these raga-dveshas, which are the basis of impulses, are the result of the past karma. So, past actions that I perform may have resulted into these raga-dveshas. That are all piled up inside, built up inside, and waiting for them to come out. And when a suitable situation arises, when somebody pushes a button, then those fellows are ready to burst out, and that's why we find ourselves reacting, having no control over ourselves. But it is the raga-dveshas that are responsible. If you want to call them vasanas, but more familiar word in Bhagavad Gita is raga-dveshas, they are responsible for the reactions. As our Swami would say that, if we manage the raga-dveshas, it is well and good. When we get managed by Ragadveshas, it is a very pitiable situation. So when we get managed by Ragadveshas, because they're so strong, that's when we go helpless, helplessly reacting in that situation. So this is an explanation of why I find myself reacting. Or a unexpected, you know, out of proportion reaction or response to a given situation. How do we deal with it? Well, when the reaction comes, there is nothing you can do. Because we are not around to do anything, our free will is gone, we are controlled by that reaction, and therefore we are made to act. What we can do is, after that reaction is over, when the mind calms down, then we can go back to that event. And now from an objective standpoint, I can ask myself, what was it that triggered this reaction in me? What did that person do? What that person did must be only a trigger of arousing the ragadvesha in me. So, as we said earlier, the anger arises because our demand or expectation is not met with. I had some expectation or demand from that person which was not met with, therefore that very expectation turns into anger. Greed, my temptations, they're all there. Maybe that one did something which is tempting to me, and therefore the temptation I reacted that way. So, kama, krodha, lobha, the lust or the tendency to indulge is always there. And then when something tempting comes, we are going, I have time to indulge. It's called kama. Krodha, when my expectation is not fulfilled. Lobha, when again I feel a sense of lack or want or dissatisfaction, that's why I want more and more and more. That's called lobha. They are all reactions. Deal with them by pratipaksha bhavana. The anger is to be dealt with by the opposite, namely kindness or compassion to the person towards whom I was angry. Greed is to be dealt with by a value of contentment. Being content in what I have. Kama, the ten indulge, is to be led by self-restraint or self-control. So these are the ways to deal with those reactions. In case you need more explanation in answer to your question, you can raise your hand and we will try to provide the explanation. Please expand on any differences between alertness or awareness and witnessing as regards to the body and mind's activities. Being aware of the thought of the mind is one thing. That I am alert or aware of the thought or the tendency that arises in my mind, that this is called attachment, this is called... So when I am aware or alert, then I can identify a given thought, that this is called attachment, aversion, etc., etc. This is called selfishness, this is called consumption, contribution. To be able to identify a given thought is first, is very important. And then alone we know what to do. So this is, for example, to follow values such as non-violence. When I have a commitment that I will not speak something that will hurt the feelings of others, part of non-violence. And then when somebody behaves in a certain manner which triggers some reaction in me, if I'm alert, then I realize that in my mind now the anger is arising. Then I have freedom to deal with it before it overtakes me, before the intensity of anger grows to a given intensity. Before that, I have freedom to neutralize that. Once that anger grows beyond an intensity, it is out of my control. So if I am alert or awareful, then I know that anger is arising, temptation is arising, the desire to indulge is arising, and then I can do what is appropriate to do. Then I have a value for being a contributor. Then when I am performing an action, I am aware, alert of what kind of tendency or attitude arises in me. Is it that of a contributor or a consumer? So when we are alert or aware, then we are aware of the thought, then we can identify what the thought is, then we can decide the strategy of what to do with that thought. That's awareness. In witnessing, I do not do anything. The thought comes and goes. When I am alert or aware, then I take action that is required for that thought. So understand that when it comes to these various reactions, of raga dvesha, being witness is not the way. Neutralizing them is the way. When a thought or reaction arises, then we should have a value for neutralizing those thoughts. Anger should be neutralized by, as we say, compassion, etc. Because otherwise, they will continue to remain in my heart. So I want my mind or heart to be free from these impulses. So as impulse arises, I identify, neutralize by pratipaksha bhavana. So this neutralizing by pratipaksha bhavana is possible provided I am alert or awareful. Witnessing is primarily during meditation. That the thoughts arise in my mind and I do not react in any way. They arise and I let them go. I do not become affected or influenced or, you know, by those thoughts. So a witness is one who is uninvolved and not influenced by what is witnessed. So when the thoughts arise, I just remain indifferent to the thought. Whether the thought is of raga, then also I let it go. Dvesha, also I let it go. Whatever thought comes, I just let it go. Meaning that I do not become influenced by that thought. That's witness. If I get influenced by the thought, I am no more a witness. If raga, dvesha arise in my mind and they influence me and drag me along with them, then I am no more a witness. So witness is the one who remains indifferent to and not controlled or influenced by the thought. What a wise person says, prakasham cha pravrttim cha mohameva cha pandava na dveshti sampravruttani na nivruttani kaankshati. The 14th chapter of the Gita, Lord Krishna describes a wise person. Usko gunatita, one has transcended the gunas. Because the three gunas are there, sattva, rajas, tamas, and they may bring up the corresponding thought, prakasham, the thought of light and knowledge, visattva, pravruttim, the thought of activity, rajas, moha, delusion, the thought of tamas. So because of the past samskaras, these thoughts may arise even in the mind of a wise person. Who is a witness? Nadveshti sampravruttani. He does not display any raga and dvesha towards the thought. That's called witness. So witness, what is meant by being indifferent is not displaying raga or dvesha. That's udasina vadasina. Remains like and uninvolved witness, udasina. So witness is one who is free from the reaction of raga and dveshas, indifferent to the thoughts, called witness. There also awareness is required, but more important is my not reacting to the thought, my just remaining indifferent to that. The alertness and awareness have value. Suppose they say, I will practice non-violence, then I am aware of my thoughts and aware of my words and make sure that they are not subject to violence. So in witnessing also alert awareness is required, no doubt about that. But awareness need not be witnessing. That's the thing. Did you have a cordless microphone? You don't have? So this is an example that the mind is made up of three gunas, sattva, rajas and tamas. That being the case, the Bhagavad Gita says that in the mind a thought arises, right? Thoughts are arising. Because it is past karma that determine what thought arises in our mind. And then a thought can be sattvic, rajas or tamas depending upon the karma. He is indifferent, meaning there is not identified. The question of reflecting comes when I get identified and react. When I am swept by the thought, controlled by the thought, then the question of analysis comes. But when I am totally indifferent to the thoughts, they come and go, I have no concern with them, no identification with them. Please explain the transition from Karma Yoga to Jnana Yoga. Lord Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Lokesmin Dvidhanishtha Paraprokta Mayanaga Jnana Yogena Sankhyana Karma Yogena Yogena. Lord Krishna says that this is a path of two stage path. First is the Karma Yoga, which is path of activity, and Jnana Yoga, the path of contemplation. So contemplation is called Vichara. It's characterized by Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam. So what is meant by Jnana Yoga is that an aspirant approaches the teacher and takes his refuge, sits at his feet, and listens to Shravanam, that is the unfoldment of the scripture on the part of the teacher. Then he reflects upon that and then he meditates upon that. So this is Jnana Yoga, a life dedicated to pursuit of knowledge. And here the pursuit of knowledge is in the form of Shravanam, Mana, Nididhyasanam. In other words, it's all called Vichara. So, athato brahma jignyasa, that brahma jignyasa, brahma vichara kartavyaya. Atha, when a certain condition is satisfied, thereafter one should do the vichara on brahma. Vichara is sometimes, but can be translated as deliberation on brahma. How do you deliberate upon brahma? You deliberate upon brahma by deliberating upon these statements of Upanishad, which reveal the nature of Brahman. So Brahman is the subject matter of the statement of the Upanishad. Therefore, in order to reflect upon Brahman or dwell upon Brahman or understand Brahman, it is necessary to understand the statements of Upanishad. And that's why we require a teacher. The teacher is the one who reveals to us the tatparya, the purport of the statements. That is the role of a teacher. We cannot ourselves understand, we can understand the grammatical meaning and stuff like that. But the intended meaning is what the teacher brings out. So this process of Jnana Yoga. As you can see, ideally, in Jnana Yoga, this aspirant is totally preoccupied with just the pursuit of knowledge. That whenever with the teacher is listening Shravanam or Mananam or then Dhyasana. Maybe part of his time also goes in serving the teacher and doing chores which are, or studying grammar and stuff like that, which are compatible to knowledge. But no activity which are in some way incompatible to knowledge. Jnana Yoga. That is the dedicated pursuit of knowledge. Karma Yoga is a stage previous to that. So when is this Jnana Yoga possible? When a person has no agenda other than pursuit of knowledge. Meaning when the mind becomes free from all agenda, that is when the pursuit of knowledge is possible, ideally. Because in those days, we had to go to the teacher. Teachers lived in far away areas and wherever. When you go to the teacher, you have to disconnect yourself from everything that you are doing because you can't commute there, you have to stay there, live there. That means that you must renounce or give up all your responsibilities, activities, rights, etc. Go to the teacher. So ideally it was a Vividisha Sannyasi, a renunciate who took the path of renunciation for the sake of pursuit of knowledge, is the one that is most suitable right for pursuing knowledge. That is why it's a Sannyasa, Vividisha Sannyasa. What is Vividisha? Vedita Michha, the sannyasa or life of renunciation taken specifically for pursuit of knowledge. But that requires a mind which is free from all agenda. Now that requires work. You have all kinds of agendas called desires. Agenda. And therefore, first stage is to live a life wherein we progressively become free from the agenda or free from these ambitions, free from the need to achieve things. Agenda arises from a need to achieve something, to become something. So as long as the mind has the orientation of becoming something, achieving something, so long it is in future, not in present. For pursuit of knowledge, the mind should be in the present. And therefore, Karma Yoga is the performance of karma, the duty, with the attitude of yoga, which is the worship of Ishvara, or being a contributor, or yajna, or self-offering. So Karma Yoga. That prepares the mind slowly and slowly to become free from the desires or agenda. You know how? How does it happen? How does the mind become free from desire? Because what you are seeking to achieve through fulfillment of a desire is what you discover within yourself. So process of karma yoga is not karma, is the yoga of attitude. So that attitude of yajna, the attitude of self-offering, attitude of worship is conducive to making the mind free from raga dveshas. As you progressively become free from raga dvesha, to that extent you discover that purity and cheerfulness from your own self. So what we desire to attain, namely happiness, by fulfilling raga dvesha, is happiness that you find yourself discovering from yourself. And that is the reason why when raga dvesha are gone, you are already self-sufficient, and therefore you cannot apply your mind to doing, because there is no distraction left now. So therefore karma yoga is the first stage. When you gain purification, very essential purification, not total, essential purification of mind, where in the words of Pujya Swamiji, you can manage raga dveshas. As long as I am managed by raga dvesha, so long karma yoga is necessary. When raga dveshas become weak enough that I can manage, meaning I can be indifferent to them, I can drop them, I can shake them off, then I become independent of them, then I am ready for jnana yoga. So karma yoga is extremely important. What is important is antahkarana shuddhi. Freedom from, essential freedom from raga dvesha, the reactions. And everybody has it in some measure or the other. This is not our first lifetime that we are pursuing this. This is an ongoing process. Sometimes Vijayji asks for history of people. You will have history, everybody will have history of how they came about. And sometimes not an explicable reason also. I mean, you just happen to walk in something, a friend told you, you read something, I saw an advertisement. Something happens and that brings you here. But that is when your past karma become fructified at that moment. And that is what is responsible for bringing us here. So this is an ongoing thing. And therefore, the antahkarana shuddhi we all possess in some measure or the other, otherwise we won't be here. When Ravana, younger brother Vibhishana, he was kicked by Ravana in his court, when he left, he said, okay, you are my elder brother, my father, I respect you, but I have no place here. He walks away, goes to Lord Ravana. And then his army is there, and so all cantonment is there. When Vibhishana reaches there, they recognize that this is a Rakshasa, a demon. And he again, young brother of Ravana, they was held there. Messenger came and informed Lord Ravana that Vibhishana, the younger brother of Ravana, is here. What should we do? So typically, Ravana being a king, he asks his minister. Sugriva is the minister at that time. So what do you think, Sugriva, we should do? Sugriva says, Lord, he is younger brother of Ravana. These are all Rakshasas. They all have Maya, the magical powers. You can never really judge them. And therefore, my opinion is that he should be arrested and held up. Then Lord Ravana tells me, look, this fellow is coming to me. The very inspiration of coming to me can arise only as a result of fructification of the past karma of many births. Otherwise, one would not think of coming to me. So that a jiva-atma comes to me itself is enough that he is a genuine person. He cannot be here for taking our secrets and stuff like that. He has come here to take refuge into us. He has come for surrender. And then you bring him here. And you are scared that he may take away the secrets. Don't worry. You know Lakshmana here? He is single-handedly capable of taking care of all, you know. Don't worry about that. So either count, bring them here. Bring him here. What I am saying is that the desire to even go to a Vedanta class, having gone there to stay there for an hour, and a desire to go again, all of this cannot happen unless there is something inside, which is the result of the past karma. So it's an ongoing thing. So karma yoga is ongoing. And we now, more we understand, more we accelerate that. But understand that this step of antahkarana shuddhi, or purification of mind, or making the mind free from raga dvesha, is a very important step. Our mind should ideally possess the Samadhi Shatka Sampatti. Shama Dama Uparama. Shama means tranquility of the mind. Dama means a control over my activity, sense organs of perception, action. Uparama, introvertedness of the mind. This should be there for us to properly benefit from the teaching. So transition of Karma Yoga to Jnana Yoga is the elimination of raga and dveshas. When that happens, then you graduate from Karma Yoga to Jnana Yoga. Now, how to attain Chitta Shuddhi? Chitta Shuddhi means the purification of mind. Same thing that we talked about. I think the question is answered. It is the right attitude. Ragadveshas represent wrong attitudes. Ragadveshas means attachment, aversion. They create attitude which will create further ragadveshas, further impurities, further bondage. And therefore, yoga means an attitude that is opposed to this attitude of ragadvesha. That I do something as not prompted by attachment and aversion, then what remains? As worship, as offering, as contribution, as selflessness. So selflessness ideally is an attitude where there is no raga or dvesha. Or the extent to which our mind is selfless, to that extent it is free from raga and dvesha. So that's how impurity of mind are nothing but wrong attitudes, and purity of mind is the right attitudes. So values and attitudes are taught to us for that purpose. Study of Vedanta is relatively new to me and I find it compelling. That's great news. Then I don't have trust in religious doctrines and that impedes my ability to understand Shraddha. Also, Shastra study is illuminating. But I need to learn more before accepting or fully trusting. How do I best move forward with Shraddha? Well, you please continue to listen, that's all. You make one commitment. Whether I trust or not, I have a commitment that I will go and attend classes on a regular basis. So, more you listen, more clarity will come to you. The trust arises when there is clarity in our mind. We do not trust these doctrines because we do not understand the doctrines very often. Vedanta is not a doctrine anywhere. Our Pujya Swami always fond of saying, Vedanta is not philosophy. It is vision. It is not a speculation. It is revealing the reality of life. So therefore, all you need to do is to listen to Vedanta. Understand. Try to understand, gain further and further clarity. And that's all. That means your Shraddha. The fact that you find the Vedanta study compelling, that means there is something in there. How do you find it compelling? That means you find that Vedanta in some way appeals to you, touches you, impacts upon you. That's why you find it compelling. That is Shraddha. That you continue on. All that we require here in Vedanta by our Shraddha is that you continue to listen to the teacher. That's all. The rest is done by teacher and scriptures. And you know. So, Shraddha requires only for you to continue to do Shravana. Not believe anything. Understand things. Vedanta does not want us to believe anything. Vedanta wants us to understand something. To the extent that Pujya Swami used to say that, you don't have to believe in Ishvara, you have to understand Ishvara. You don't have to believe that you are limitless. That's what Vedanta, you are limitless. You don't believe in that, you don't understand. How can I understand that? So Vedanta does not preach, it teaches. It unfolds. Vedantic teacher makes a statement, you are limitless. That's what he says. And then unfold the statement, in what way you are limitless? How can I be limitless? Alright, first understand who you are. Is this body you are? Or the mind you are? The intellect you are? That is how you are made to see that what I think I is not what I really am. And thus more understanding, insight I get into myself, then more meaningful the statement becomes to me. And it may take time to gain clarity. But the consistent exposure to the teaching is all that is required. Nothing more than you don't have to believe in anything. Don't believe in any doctrine. Don't have to believe. Because this teaching is not belief, it is understanding. Vedanta appeals to our understanding rather than our belief system. Because what the point is that it is not that to believe in Ishvara, because what is it? See, you do not need to believe in something that you experience. You don't have to believe that it's daytime. You experience that. When experience is not there, then the belief comes. I do not experience heaven, therefore belief has place that maybe there is heaven, I should believe or not believe it, you know. So belief is when God is different from us. These are all faiths. All of them accept God as separate from us, as different from the world. He is not here. He is in some place that, no, that is where belief comes. What does Vedanta teach? What is God? Oh, even this is God? Yes. How? Understand. That's all. So the statement, what is God, is not to be believed, is to be understood. So Vedanta appeals to our intellect, which always wants to understand. And therefore, Shraddha here is not to be translated as belief. Is to be translated as a commitment that arises in me to continue to study. What is the difference between Sakshi and Drashta? Sakshi means witness, Drashta means seer, no difference really. Sakshi and Drashta, they are different words. Drush means to see, you know, and Sakshad Ikshade means to see also, and then word Sakshi also means witness, but Drashta also means seer. Now, you can uninvolved seer is called witness if you want to say that, but then Drashta and Sakshi need not necessarily be different. Because both are really Drashta is relative to Drushya. Drashta can be translated as seer, and seer is with reference to what is seen. But Sakshi is witness. Witness also is with reference to what is witnessed. You know? In that sense, there is no big difference between Sakshi and Drashta. However, the word Sakshi is used in a specific sense, that Sakshi Bhavaha, the attitude of being a witness. Meaning that, as we said earlier, not being involved in what is going on, being indifferent to what is going on. So a Sakshi is necessarily indifferent to what he witnesses. A Drashta is a seer, and he may not be a Sakshi, he may get involved. In that case, we may use the word Sakshi or witness, so the one is not involved in what is witnessed. And Drashta is a seer with reference to what is seen. But Drashta may react also. If you want to distinguish between the two, That kind of distinction can be made. So long-term students no longer attend classes or lectures. Does that mean they have reached moksha? You see, this is a very pertinent question. That it happens sometimes that we lose interest. As long as listening to Vedanta remains an intellectual pursuit, Vedanta appeals to our intellect. It gives us new insight, and there is a joy of learning. As long as new learning takes place, so long there is a joy. But unfortunately, we do not have enough time to keep up with this learning, and therefore we become saturated. In order for you to learn the deeper meaning, it is necessary to be committed to learning. Maybe necessary to learn Sanskrit also. And be committed, not just listening while going and commuting and stuff like that. That is okay. Only when you become a serious student who now wants to understand the meaning of this more and more, who wants clarity, that is when you will continue to attend class. Otherwise, what the intellect wants is variety. Either listen to something. So whatever joy of listening was to come has come. Now what next? Teach us something different. There is gone. Something different. There is gone. Something different. So here the joy coming is not so much from, it is called rasaswada. Like any object of sense that I enjoy, and I enjoy the rasa or the pleasure coming from that, this also becomes a pursuit of gaining pleasure from new understanding and new insights. And then when that stops coming, when I do not find any new rasa in that, then slowly I lose interest. So this Swami, new text, this I have done. So we have to examine what it is that I am seeking. Am I seeking the pleasure from this listening? Nothing wrong in it. It's sattvic pleasure, but still it remains a pleasure of learning rather than the ananda of the self. Understand that. So the pleasure that I get by listening to Vedanta, which gives me new insights, is all great, but then at a certain point, everything has a value of diminishing return. In the beginning, Vedanta was very exciting, and slowly now, then I lose because its return becomes, it diminishes. And therefore, it no more gives me the same kind of excitement it did before, and then I lose interest, then I stop. But only when we grow along with Vedanta, as I say, a simultaneous pursuit must be for antahkarana shuddhi, the purification of mind. In that case, the happiness doesn't remain merely an intellectual rasaswada or intellectual joy, it slowly should convert itself into the happiness of the self. If that does not happen, then we get saturated. Somebody used the word fatigue. It says, donor fatigue, Swamiji. Aim for Seva also come, this also come, fatigue. So Vedanta fatigue, I guess, may come, enough. Then, rather than judging Vedanta, we have to look at ourselves and see what I need to do to grow so that I can gain a different dimension of what is taught to me. And so we have to grow into our purification of mind. That must be constantly there. following the right values, right attitudes, doing what is right, avoiding what is convenient, the value of, you know, interaction also, the value of compassion, this should be there. We cannot be indifferent to those things and expect to Vedanta to help us, because it helps us up to a certain at an intellectual level. But to be really helped at the level of the self, we have to also do that grow. And so, maybe these people who are not coming may have various reasons. I don't have to judge them. But one of the reasons could be this, that they are saturated. Meaning that they have not undertaken a conscious pursuit of purifying the mind with which they can gain different dimensions of the same statement, same teaching. So, this is not an uncommon phenomenon anyway, it's a common phenomenon. Anybody have any questions? We have a cordless microphone. Please speak into that. Pass on the microphone.
For deeper study of Veda, is it necessary to study Sanskrit and Nyaya and Mimamsa, etc.?
Well, ideally, yes. Usually, the teacher makes up for our lack of knowledge of Sanskrit and Nyaya and Mimamsa. I would think that a reasonable knowledge of Vyakaranam and a little bit knowledge of Tarka, not Nyaya Shastra, basic reasoning. Mimamsa, if you don't understand, doesn't matter much. But Sanskrit, more you understand, better it is, because when the teacher unfolds the meaning of a word or meaning of a sentence, then if you know the grammatical meaning also, that makes it, you know, facilitates understanding more. It also gives an ability to then, repeat the study when you go home. You can go back to that. So Sanskrit is a very desirable thing. And Tarka to some extent, just Anumanam. That's all we need is the inference. That's all we have to understand. Nothing more than that. Mimamsa is not necessary. Mimamsa is necessary in a sense. Mimamsa means the analysis of a sentence. In that sense, it to some extent becomes necessary. Because certain principles of how to analyze a vakya are accepted by Vedantins in the same manner. Whatever principles are developed by Mimamsa in terms of the analysis of a sentence are also accepted by Vedanta. Now, Mimamsa is a whole shastra of karma kanda which we need not much worry about. But Mimamsa in the sense of analysis of a sentence or a text is a desirable thing. It comes along with the study anyway. When you study the Bhashya, Bhashyakara does analyze. That is called Mimamsa. But perhaps some introductory understanding of that may be helpful. And when you want to continue to study Vedanta, then you have to get into deeper meanings also, wherein all this will help. Alright?
Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo.